You are listening to an entertainment program put together by a company called Financial Ineptitude. Anything said on this show is not an endorsement or professional advice. Would you really want to tell a court of law you were suing us because you thought taking financial advice from two idiots on a podcast put out by Financial Ineptitude was a good idea? Really? Clown hat, smiley face.
Financial Ineptitude presents Two Bulls in a China Shop. You can find our podcast at twobullsinachinashop.com or just search Two Bulls in a China Shop wherever you stream your podcasts. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. You've made it to another exciting episode of Two Bulls in a China Shop. I'm Shopkeeper Dan. With me, as always, is Kyle, creator of financialineptitude.com. How are you doing today, Kyle?
I am excited. We've got a fantastic guest lined up for today.
All right. Yeah. Well, why don't you introduce him?
Oh, I thought you were doing that part now. Okay. Ian Frazier. We've got Ian Frazier, the best-selling author, can I say that, of Shredded, the story of the bank that broke Britain.
Hi.
Can we call you a bestseller?
Book is You're a bestseller, right? But yeah, I don't know if I'm... Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you get that. Okay, we'll give you that title. It's not as good as a knighthood, but you know, we'll do what we can for you. How are you doing, Ian?
I'm really well. I'm sitting here in Scotland, and I'm looking forward to this chat. I wrote the book Shredded, Inside RBS, The Bank That Broke Britain I started it in 2012. I finished writing it in 2014. And then I had a rewrite. Well, not a rewrite. I produce a totally revised and updated edition in 2019, because there's been a lot of things that have happened in the intervening 5 years or so. So it's been a labor of love, if that's the right way of putting
it. I bet.
Or a labor of hate, even.
It's almost like peeling an onion, it seems like, with this story. Like, the deeper you go, the deeper it keeps going.
That's right. I mean, the bank is much more stable now than it was. It went through, after it was bailed out and rescued with what I think was the largest bailout of any bank in the world in 2008. It was pretty sort of unstable and, you know, yo-yoing around, and there were lots of outstanding court cases, and there was lots of management changes and things like that. But it does seem to be slightly more stable now, but it's a pale shadow of its former self, because it was the largest bank in the world by assets in 2008 at the time of its collapse, and it's now about 30, it's below 30th in the world by assets. So it's really shrunk, you know, it's shrunk a lot in the past 12, 14 years, largely just by, you know, selling assets and disposing parts of itself, including most of its U.S. operations.
I was actually kind of surprised that so many different foreign banks operate in other countries. Like, to me, that seems like I wouldn't feel comfortable as an American having my money, you know, in the hands of Chinese bankers, for, you know, as an example.
I think Europeans are more used to it. You know, we have this thing called the European Union, and within that, banks have operated quite freely in other countries. So, you know, for example, I know a bank with a Swedish bank called Handelsbanken, because I know it's pretty solid and reliable, well capitalized, etc. And I'm perfectly comfortable with that. And I think, you know, RBS clearly did face problems when it was trying to expand in the US, because Americans aren't very used to using banks that aren't American owned.
I was going to say, yeah, but we have other banks, not just RBS, that has a footprint or had a footprint here. I think like HBSC, isn't that a Hong Kong owned?
Yeah, HSBC, which is Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, possibly one of the most evil banks in the world.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah.
It was actually founded in Hong Kong.
I remember they got busted for drug money.
That's right. They had a $1.9 billion settlement to avoid being shut down by the U.S. authorities in 2012 or something like that. But
really?
Yeah, but they're actually UK headquartered now. They moved their headquarters from Hong Kong to the UK in 1990, in the early 1990s, when they took over a UK bank called Midland. But yeah, that's got a really appalling record of, you know, fueling tax evasion, fueling, facilitating drug cartels in Mexico, and facilitating money laundering. And it hasn't, you know, even though...
Jeez. Is that the next book?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I could face on HSBC, but who knows? There's still, there's a possibility.
Well, let's we took a little segue there. Let's get back to the RBS story. I haven't finished the book yet, so I'm excited to learn how, you know, they get their comeuppance and they pay back all that bailout money and all these people went to jail.
Yes, I wish.
What? That didn't happen? God damn it.
The reality was that the board who was in charge of RBS at the time of its 08 collapse, you know, mainly left with their wealth more or less intact. So they had very large pensions, you know, in some cases up to $1 million a year in pension money coming in. And there was not much clawback, or there was no clawback of past bonuses. We had a very weak regulatory establishment. Really? Yeah, a very weak regulatory establishment here in the UK. Who just kind of slapped them over the knuckles and said they'd made a few mistakes, allowed them to waltz off into the sunset with their swag bags intact. So,
Jesus.
Yeah, about the only punishment that, there were two main punishments that I can think of, one of which was that the chief executive, Sir Fred Goodwin, had his knighthood removed by the British government. The honours.
Do they do that with a sword?
I don't think so. They should, but it was yes. It was the Honours Forfeiture Committee was doesn't sit very often, but it sat, and they decided they were going to relieve him of his knighthood, and that happened, I think, in January 2012. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happened was one guy called Johnny Cameron, who was the head of the investment bank. He was formally censured by the Financial Services Authority, which was the then regulator, since changed its name, and he was told he wasn't allowed to have any other high level roles in the financial sector. But apart from that, I can't think of anyone being punished. Fred Goodwin did actually voluntarily hand back some of his pension. He was due to receive about £700,000 per annum as pension for life, but there was an uproar about that in early 2009. And a lot of pressure. There was no legal way that you could have forced him to hand back some of the pension, but he did voluntarily agree to hand back about half. So it came down to £340,000 per
annum. Oh, that's nice of him.
Yes.
Yeah. And he kept all the other money that he made too.
Yeah. It was a mark of incredible decency on his part.
Yes.
At least his stock options were worthless.
That's true. The stock options were pretty much worthless. And I mean, I don't know if you want to know more about Fred Goodwin now, but, you know, then we could discuss that later.
Yeah.
Well, now he has suffered a loss of face. Obviously, you know, he was fated as the guy who had transformed a provincial bank into the largest bank in the world by assets. In the space of 8 years between 2000 and 2008. Mm-hmm. So he was lauded, you know, in Edinburgh society and in London society and internationally as this great, you know, God's gift to banking who was supposedly doing everything right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that all went to his head, and he could easily meet the prime minister or the president or the central bank governor of whichever country he visited. So, you know, he's gone from that to being basically a pariah, and he lives more or less as a recluse in Edinburgh.
With all his millions.
Yeah.
I'm sure. I would, if the show ever gets canceled, that's the fate I hope I have to endure. Yeah.
Oh, just take my money and go home.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the end of the world for him.
I think he's doing just fine.
Yeah.
So, we talked a little bit about Goodwin. I want to talk a little bit more about Matheson, because I think he was kind of the one who sort of kicked off the path that the bank kind of went down.
He thinks he rescued RBS from near collapse in 1991, when it was essentially, well, not bust, but it was in danger of having to axe its dividend, which at that time was pretty much the same as being bust if you were a bank. And he basically, I say, picked it up by the scruff of its neck and gave it a really good kicking. And he sacked about 100 or 200 of the top 300 staff in a what's been called a knight of the long knives. Mm-hmm. And he retained people who he thought were more dynamic and entrepreneurial and younger and more interested in selling. And so, he did do what might be deemed to be some good things. He put it back on a path to profitability. And he embarked on this thing called Project Columbus, which was all about making the bank more efficient, introducing better mm-hmm. computers, axing...
Or computers at all. Weren't they still doing everything on paper?
Well, they did have some, but they were pretty primitive. So yeah, computers at all. And it was also about basically transforming the branch network. In the old days, the branches were like mini fiefdoms, and the individual manager of that branch or region mm-hmm. had a lot of control over who he lent to, and it was usually a man, who they lent mm-hmm. to, and understood their local community. So there was a sort of old-fashioned way of doing banking, which revolved around understanding your community
right.
and understanding their ability to repay loans and all that sort of stuff. But Matthewson got rid of that. He got rid of the gray-haired and quite powerful local branch managers and local regional managers. And I would say hollowed out the branches and made them more like sales outposts. Mm-hmm. And this was quite early for British banking. He was one of the first bank chief executives to do this and encourage cross-selling, which meant that if someone already had a current account, you've got to sell them other products. Like, it could be insurance, it could be deposit accounts, it could be car loans, or,
Right.
So it's all about hucksterism and selling your existing customer base more products and trying to make the bank more profitable that way. So there was nothing necessarily wrong with that, but I think it set a sort of mindset within RBS, which probably to some extent helped to sow the seeds of the trouble that it had later on in the 2000s.
I really feel like those effects are being felt like still today. Like, I don't know how many letters I get from my bank asking me about refinancing or moving all my IRA over to them, or like, it just feels like they're all just always trying to sell to me now. Whereas before mm-hmm. I used to be a customer, now I'm a product almost.
Yes. I think it's a sad development within banking, probably worldwide, but certainly in the US and UK, mm-hmm. That basically they just see you as a product, as you say, a product. Something that they can sell more products to in order to boost their shareholder value. So yeah. I do say in the book that the and I'm sure this has affected all banks, but there was a sort of change that happened in about the 70s under Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, which was all about that companies' sole purpose was to enrich their shareholders and enrich their ownership base. And mm-hmm. I think from that flowed a multitude of sins, one of which was the banks basically, if they see their sole objective as being to enrich their shareholders, they tend to go for short-term maneuvers which will boost shareholder value in the short term, and which might be harmful to staff, or they might be harmful to customers, or harmful to society, or harmful to the environment, because they've been told that doesn't matter.
Right.
They've been told the only thing that matters is, boosting the share price.
So I'd even say that's not just, an issue in the banking industry. That's pretty much any publicly traded company.
Yeah.
I think by law, they're required to try to do things that, enrich shareholder value, at least in the US.
Yes, I think it is. It's widespread across the whole business, the whole world of business, and listed companies in particular.
Mm-hmm.
In certain banks, I think it just drove more egregious behavior. But I think with RBS, the other thing was, because it was basically a mid-sized UK bank, it was terrified of being taken over when consolidation started in the 90s. Mm. And they had this mantra, which was, you either eat or be eaten. And so, the fact that you're a mid-sized bank in a mid-sized country like the UK, the chances are that you would be eaten, as in taken over by JP Morgan, or taken over by Citibank, or taken over by Barclays or Lloyds, one of the English banks, or even HSBC. So they decided that to avoid that fate, they would have to eat themselves, as in grow by acquisition and take over other banks. Mm-hmm. And they tried throughout the 90s to basically acquire other banks in the UK, but they constantly failed to achieve what they wanted, because they got basically gazumped, or I don't know if you use that word, they got outbid by rivals such as Lloyds. Mm-hmm. And And the guy running it was to some extent quite cautious. You know, he didn't want to overpay for other banks. And that guy was George Matheson. But then what happened, basically, after they did manage to secure the takeover of a bank three times their size, National Westminster Bank, in March 2000, they sort of believed they could just continue to grow by acquisition, and it didn't matter how good or bad the bank that they bought was. So the obsession with growth, it was almost like there was an obsession with growth at all costs. And shareholders and analysts were not vigilant enough in monitoring this. And they did make, you know, some good acquisitions, but they also made some appalling acquisitions after NatWest, one of which was Charter One, which was an Ohio-based bank. I don't know if you've heard of it, but...
I've heard of Charter, but I know there's a Charter Steel. That's a steel company. I don't know if they're related.
I don't think so. No, Charter One was is a bank based in Cleveland, Ohio. And RBS bought that for about $10.6 billion in 2014. But they didn't really bother to do their due diligence. And the bank had a lot of subprime-like lending on its books and ultimately proved to be worth less than $2 billion. So they actually, you know, overpaid by at least five times when they bought that bank in the US. It was all part of growing their Citizens Financial Corporation division, which was headquartered in Providence, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And Citizens was a bank which RBS had owned since 88. And they'd grown it through an incredible series of acquisitions of failed thrifts and other banks which they picked up quite cheaply from 92 all the way through to 2007. There was a period of about, you know, nearly a decade and a half when they were growing Citizens by buying small regional banking groups and bolting them on and rebranding those as Citizens. Mm-hmm. But again, I think there was a problem that they didn't do sufficient due diligence on some of these deals, and they were just obsessed with the scale and the glory of, you know, of basically snapping up foreign banks.
During your research, did you ever figure out why they didn't do a comprehensive due diligence? As I think that really kind of, you know, came back to bite them when they did the ABN deal, and they kept referring to the NatWest acquisition. We're just doing it like that. We're doing what they call a due diligence light.
Yes.
But light.
When you're spending that, you know, $10 billion, why the hell are you not poring over the books and protecting yourself?
It does seem very, very odd. And I do think the NatWest... I think the NatWest deal, it was partly responsible for that, mm-hmm. because they believed they had made such cost savings in the wake of the acquisition of NatWest through sacking 18,000 employees and crunching together operating networks and consolidating IT and all that sort of stuff, that it didn't really matter if they'd slightly overpaid for NatWest. Because the cost savings that flowed out of that were so big, they paid, you know, they almost paid for the slight overpayment for that they may have made for NatWest. And I think this sort of mantra was that, you know, we're such good consolidators, we're the best at consolidating in the world, we're recognized as such by Harvard Business School, who did a case study on the NatWest deal.
you still need to look at the books to know where you can save.
Well, exactly.
Don't you?
I mean, I'm sure they did do due diligence light on most of the deals, on all the deals they did. But the trouble was it was too light.
Yeah.
And it is something which I don't even to this day fully understand. But I think it partly arose from arrogance. That they felt they were just the, you know, God's gift to bank consolidation, God's gift to banking mergers, and they'd been praised so highly over the way NatWest had panned out, that they thought, oh well, doesn't a slight overpayment won't matter.
A slight overpayment, maybe. Like with the Charter deal, like you overpay by five times, that's kind of hard to come back from.
And with ABN AMRO, the Dutch bank, you know,
Yeah, so to kind of give the listeners a broader picture of what we're talking about, in, what was it, 2007, the Royal Bank of Scotland made this acquisition deal full of subprime debt that just completely tanked the stock, completely tanked the company. I believe they actually ran out of money at one point.
Yes, well, it was an extraordinary acquisition. And again, it was partly driven by Fred Goodwin's obsession with scale, because Barclays was also trying to take over ABN AMRO. And Barclays, which is a rival UK bank, had already made an offer, which I think had been provisionally accepted by the board of ABN AMRO. But this was just very irksome to Fred, because if this had happened, Barclays would have leapfrogged over RBS and become bigger than it again. And he didn't want that to happen. So one of the reasons he was so desperate to buy it was to avoid that scenario occurring. But what he also did, which was incredibly unwise, was to offer to pay 90% of the $100 billion purchase price of ABN AMRO in cash,
right,
and borrow that on the short-term interbank lending market. So this was basically ultimately what killed RBS, because the bank ended up with a £160 billion funding gap between its deposits and it ended up with a £160 billion funding gap. And when markets froze, and they started to freeze when the credit crisis first really made itself felt in July 2007, and obviously it completely froze on September the 14th or 15th, 2008, with the Lehman Brothers collapse. Basically, RBS couldn't survive from that moment on. So, yeah, his decision to pay 90% of the purchase price in cash was an absolute disaster.
It's just mind-boggling, the numbers and the figures that you're talking about. Like, how does something get to be this big?
Yeah, well,
and be that reckless at the same time.
It is hard to believe, because even though Citigroup and Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers were doing crazy stuff in the subprime market, and they all needed bailouts themselves to some extent with TARP. Mm-hmm. They weren't doing anything quite as crazy as what RBS was doing with its ABN AMRO acquisition. And in fact, there is a chart which the Financial Times produced soon after RBS collapsed in 2009. And it was like a Venn diagram of all the things that any bank could do wrong in terms of weak capital, in terms of crazy deals, in terms of exposure to subprime. And RBS was right at the center. It had basically done everything, every single thing. I can send you that if you want.
I'm trying to find it right now.
It's hard to find, because it was like FT chart from a while back, and it's fine. But I can probably
send me that, because I'm going to post that on the website when we upload this.
Definitely.
So it is extraordinary. And that's one of the reasons why it was a fun book to write, because, the bank really had, it almost like it had pulled out all the stops to do as many things wrong as it could.
Yeah, you were able to actually talk to some of these people too when you were doing the research for this book. How many of them didn't want to be named, just out of curiosity?
Well, I think I spoke to about 120 people, and they varied from senior board directors and ex-board directors of RBS right down to, corporate lending managers or much people more low down in the hierarchy, and also to investment bank advisors who used to advise the board of RBS. But I'd say of those 120 people, there was only about five who were prepared to talk on the record. About 115 were too nervous to do so and preferred to talk off the record, as we call it, i.e. without being named. So, yeah, and not many people were particularly proud of what the bank had achieved or willing to go public about it. I was grateful to those who did. I named them in the acknowledgements, because, it would have been much nicer if I had more people who were willing to go on the record, but sadly, there were only that number. And, I was very grateful to those that did.
Yeah, it's a tale that kind of needs to be told. And
yeah,
getting some of that firsthand account, I think, really makes the story better.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like when Jared Bibler was doing his research as Jared Bibler, who wrote Iceland Secret, when he was doing his investigation as a regulator in Iceland, he found these jaw-dropping things. Like, he discovered that the three Icelandic banks had been rigging their own share prices by hoovering up their own shares.
Yeah.
For immense, extraordinary, like, for immense periods of time, sometime dating back to 1998 in the case of one bank.
Right.
So that's a whole 10 years, but between then and its collapse.
I noticed that when you said your bank with somebody that's not, you know, in Scotland, it wasn't in Iceland.
No, thank God. No, I would never choose an Icelandic bank. I really wouldn't. But you know, as I was writing it, I just discovered these new things, and you know, things like the performance management system, or things like the way they, you know, the board had repeatedly lied, even though they knew perfectly well they were heavily involved in subprime. They lied to their investors. They lied to the analysts. They lied to the regulators. So I just, you know, my jaw was dropping as I was researching it and writing it.
Yeah, I was watching the BBC documentary, and they were playing the clips of the board talking to investors, and investors asking the very reasonable direct questions like, you got any acquisitions going on? Like, what's happening?
Yes.
And there's you can actually find the shift where they start all like blinking like crazy. They're shifting around and squirming in their seats, and they're just bold-faced lying.
Yes.
Over and over. At one point, he even like looks into the camera to tell his lie. It was like watching a bad 80s movie. Like, I can't believe this was reality in real life.
No, that was quite extraordinary, because basically Fred Goodwin had been told by investors that he had to stop making any further acquisitions after Charter One, because it had been such a disaster. Mm-hmm. And, you know, investors were not pleased. You know, they're meant to be stewards of other people's money, supposedly. They're looking after funds which are invested on behalf of ordinary people, or pension savers, mm-hmm. or just ordinary investors. And so they have a duty to sort of, you know, kick the tires and prod the wheels or whatever of a company mm-hmm. that they're invested in. And they were really concerned about RBS. They were so concerned about RBS basically squandering money on megalomaniac type activity, or, you know, self-aggrandizing activity, like just buying an American bank, which was worth actually five times less than they paid. And so they basically put Fred Goodwin in a box and said, you must not do any more deals. You have to go for what's called organic growth. Grow the balance sheet organically by, you know, just enlarging your activities from within, selling more loans or whatever it might have been.
Right.
But not through any more acquisitions, and you are banned from doing that. But at that particular meeting you're talking about, they sensed that Fred Goodwin was already about to do another one, and he was about to buy a large stake in the Bank of China, based in Beijing. And, you know, there was a lot of unrest about that. But as you say, when they said that, oh, no, we're not planning any more deals, all those guys, that entire board was lying through their teeth.
What about when they were talking about their exposure to the subprime loans? Were they flat out lying when they were saying that they had none, or did they really not know?
No, they were flat out lying, because they knew that RBS was heavily engaged in subprime mortgages through its Greenwich Capital division in Greenwich, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And this division was already boasting that it was a market leader in the origination, sales, and trading of asset-backed securities, which includes subprime. And this division had underwritten $188 billion of subprime mortgage-backed securities between 2003 and 2007. It was vying for the top slot with Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and Citigroup. So basically, you know, it securitized up to $50 billion a year of subprime debt. So if the board didn't know that, then they shouldn't have been on the board.
That was kind of the impression I got. But then the other thing I was wondering too is, I mean, I know in the US, like, you have to publish your financial statements. Like, aren't these things that people should have been able to find, like, looking through those statements that they have to file, or no?
Yeah, well, the bank was audited by a firm called Deloitte. And there's this huge question mark over how thorough Deloitte was. I mean, Deloitte hasn't been penalized at all.
Was it audit light?
Yes, it was audit light. Yeah, it was so light. So light. But there was just a, you know, huge question mark over how vigilant that audit firm was, that Big Four audit firm was, of what was going on. And yes, you do have to declare in your annual accounts what you are doing. But you see, with subprime, I think they were able to fudge it because they weren't necessarily required to state that they were engaged in repackaging subprime debt. They could just say it is RMBS, residential mortgage-backed securities, or they could just say... ABS, asset-backed securities. But they were, when they were specifically asked about subprime in several meetings in 2007, that's when they should have been, you know, they should have been more honest.
Right.
And particularly with the Victor Hong situation in September to November 2007, he was trying to make the bank be honest about the valuations of the CDO of the CDOs that it had on its books, the top tier CDOs that it had on its books. And, you know, he was determined that it should actually reflect the true valuations of these things, which were about 30%, $0.30 in the dollar. So if they were valuing them at 100, they should have been valuing them at 30 cents, which is exactly what Merrill Lynch and Citigroup had already done that year. And so Hong was being entirely correct in his assessment, but the guys at RBS Granite, including the senior executives there, basically knew that if this happened, they were going to lose their bonuses for that year.
Oh, God.
So they dragged their heels and said, we're not going to accept Victor Hong's accurate valuations. We're going to pretend it's worth 90 cents in the dollar. And that was what was fed back to head office in Edinburgh. And the board sort of were perfectly happy to accept that. And so was Deloitte. So, you know, there were some real issues going on internally. But and this is why Victor Hong decided he basically had to resign, because he didn't want to be associated with what could be deemed fraud. To be fraudulent.
Wow. I mean, it's good to know that at least some people still have some sort of conscience.
I've got these two sets of numbers.
Yeah, one of them is going to make your bank seem as if it's bankrupt, and one of them is going to make it seem as if your bank's still highly successful. Which one will you
pick?
Which
do I want to believe? Which do I want to believe?
It's, oh God, between your book and the one you referenced earlier, Jared Bibler's, like, it just astounds me, like, the type of shenanigans that go on behind the scenes. Just to try to live one more day.
A giant bank.
It is. It is. It's actually really, really disturbing.
Yeah.
I mean, you do wonder whether similar things, I mean, Jared believes that similar things are happening, you know, could be happening anywhere in the world in any institution.
I would say it's quite likely.
Yeah. We don't have a strong enough culture of maybe of ethics within the financial sector, but we certainly don't have powerful enough regulators. And we have politicians, certainly in this country, who are basically uninterested in banking or finance. And often there's a form of state capture because the banks give a lot of donations to the party that's in power here called the Conservative Party. And that might just buy them some influence, or certainly does buy them some influence in terms of, you know, the shape of regulation. And, you know, currently in the UK, even though we embarked on a regulatory race to the bottom in 2003 under Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, we've now got the same thing happening under Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak, who, that's the Prime Minister and the Chancellor.
Is there something wrong with Boris Johnson, by the way?
In what way?
He just looks like he just got out of bed every time I see him.
Well, I mean, I don't really know what's wrong with Boris Johnson. Well, I know there's a lot wrong with Boris Johnson. But I don't know physically. Yeah, you're right. He looks a mess. His hair is a mess. He kind of looks a bit dopey, as if he's only just... woken up, as you
said. Looks like he just woke up and, like, walked into the press conference straight out of bed.
I respect that about him.
Yeah.
I mean, with the world leader, I think you want a little more professionalism.
People now think that Tony Blair was a disastrous prime minister, partly because he pushed George Bush to go into the Iraq War in 2003. But, you know, at least he knew how to present himself. But I mean, if you want other examples of the dishonesty, like in 2008, RBS needed cash. It was held below the waterline. It had to build up its capital reserves, which were depleted because of the crash, you know, because of the ongoing credit crisis. And it was worse in March when Bear Stearns collapsed. There was a kind of huge blip in credit markets in March 2008 when Bear Stearns collapsed and had to be rescued. But so they were told by the regulator here, which was called the Financial Services Authority, they had to do a rights issue, i.e. tap their existing shareholders for money, and they had to raise as much as they possibly could. And so they launched a rights issue in April 2008, and they got a total of 12.5 billion sterling in raised from their existing investors. And these included a lot of small-time investors, a lot of whom worked for RBS, because a lot of people who worked there bought shares in it because they believed in the bank. And the trouble was, when they did this, they basically committed a lot of what I would call sins of omission and sins of commission, in that basically, you know, they understated their exposure to toxic credit derivatives. Mm-hmm. They understated their short-term funding requirement. They have to issue a prospectus, which is like 300 or 400 page document, which is rubber stamped by top law firms to raise this money. By the way, when you're doing a rights issue and issuing new shares, either in an IPO or an ongoing rights issue, you have to do a prospectus, which is a very critical legal document. But they neglected, they neglected to mention that the 10.9 billion cash payment from the sale of LaSalle had been delayed. And that was a US bank, which they didn't get. They neglected to mention that RBS's core tier one capital had fallen to as little as 3.6% in April 2008. Hmm. They neglected to mention the bank had breached or was close to breaching its individual capital guidance under Basel rules. They played down all the problems they were having with the ABN AMRO integration. They failed to acknowledge the fact that ABN AMRO was overvalued on RBS's books. Mm-hmm. And they failed to admit the inadequacies of RBS's back office risk management and controls. And they failed to admit that RBS had an incomplete knowledge of its own financial position. So all these things, there were about 10 things I listed then. You know, if that had been admitted in the prospectus, I doubt these investors would have handed over 12.5 billion of their own money to RBS in order to that the bank could continue to exist. And by the way, that money had gone to zero within about 5 months.
I was going to say, that was in April 2008 that they announced the rights issue. I think you said they collected, what, about 12 billion?
Yeah, just over.
And then in August of 2008, they still managed to report a half year loss of 691 million?
Yes, exactly.
Is that including that 12 billion that they collected? Because that's insanity to me.
That 690 million loss for the first half, it was more on operations rather than on what they'd raised in capital.
Okay.
But even so, it was a bad sign.
Yes.
And by for the full year of 2008, they made the largest loss in UK financial history, 28 billion sterling. So, you know, and all the people, including small investors, including, you know, mid-level and low-level staff within RBS, who basically had been bullied to invest in the rights issue by their managers and had been offered soft loans by the bank to invest in the rights issue.
Oh my God.
Ended up finding that the money they put into it was worth nearly zero. So I think this was a terrible crime, actually. I think of all the things RBS did, this was one of the worst. You know, basically what they did was that the investors tried to sue RBS to try and get some money back. And RBS used what I would describe as almost every dirty trick in the book in order to ensure it didn't have to pay much. Ugh. And it racked up legal costs of £125 million on its lawyers, Herbert Smith Freehills, which is a London firm.
Oh my God.
And in the end, it settled out of court, but it handed over just $1 billion to the investor groups that were trying to sue it, because they were scared that if they lost, they'd have to pay all the bank's costs,
right?
Which would have been $125 million. But there's evidence that RBS basically did this because they knew they were going to lose, and they would have lost far more if they had gone to court and if the case had been court. But they'd also have had to face the ignominy or embarrassment of former senior executives, including Fred Goodwin and Johnny Cameron, having to give evidence in court. And, you know, that could have been, well, it would have become a national story if that had happened.
It should have been.
Yeah, it should have been. But it was all about, as I put it in one article, sparing them their blushes. So that was a big disappointment for me as a journalist, actually, because it, and I think for a lot of people in the UK, because We would have liked to have actually seen these guys explain themselves in a court with a QC, that's the Queen's Counsel, it's a top barrister, you know, cross-examining them and finding out what the hell they were playing at when they were running the bank. But unfortunately, this opportunity never arose.
And that's a shame, too. What was the cost to the taxpayers to bail this company out?
Well, the total cost was 1.3 trillion sterling to bail out the UK banking sector, which included RBS as the biggest failure, and Lloyds and HBOS and Bradford and Bingley and Alliance and Leicester and other banks. But the total cost of the capital that we bought in RBS as taxpayers was 45.5 billion pounds sterling.
I would say, yeah, people have a right to go demand some answers.
Exactly. And it's one of the reasons I read the book, because I felt if people have had to pay that much money to save a bank, and we're never going to get that back, by the way, you know, unlike in the US where banks paid back their TARP money, RBS is unlikely ever to repay that in full, because its share price at the time of the rescue was £5 per share. And now the bank share price is more like £2 per share. So there's no way we're ever going to get the 45.5 billion back.
But weren't they also supposed to sell off some of their branches in order to kind of like help pay some of that back?
Well, they have. They have sold off Citizens Financial, including Charter One in the States. They've basically shut down most of their investment banking operations. Mm-hmm. They've sold Direct Line, their insurance company, and they have closed or sold some of their branches in the UK. But the money doesn't seem to end up in taxpayers' pockets.
No, it doesn't. doesn't that always seem to only flow one way?
Well, that's the trouble. Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, you know, because of RBS's collapse in October 2008 and the wider banking crisis in this country, mm-hmm. which was exacerbated by New Labour's lax attitude towards regulation from 97 to 2008. We actually had a, you know, period of austerity in the UK. We had falling real wages. We had, you know, slashed budgets from local government, mm-hmm. you know, so primary schools and playgrounds closing and libraries closing and community centres closing. And, you know, we call this a period of austerity when basically Tory Lib Dem government was axing expenditure in the UK. And that was a direct consequence of the banking crash of 08. So I felt that people might want to know, you know, why we were going through that. What was it that had caused RBS, which is now called NatWest, mm-hmm. to fail and to cost the country so dear or so much money?
What sort of feedback did you get after you did publish?
Well, I think one of the best things I got was actually from, I heard that the new chief risk officer at RBS, who'd come in after the crash, had actually recommended my book on the RBS intranet site, saying everybody in the bank should read this. It's a painful read, but there are a lot of lessons to be learned. And so I was quite grateful that, you know, this guy had actually recommended it on the staff intranet site to all staff. You know, instead of having 250,000 staff, which is what they had at the time of their collapse, they still had around 70 to 80,000 at that stage.
God damn, that is insane.
So I was quite pleased. You know, I'm not sure how many actually bought it, but maybe some got it out from the library. But I was also glad that the bank was selling. Sorry, the book Shredded was selling very well There's a branch of Blackwell's inside the RBS headquarters, which is this vast campus-style HQ west of Edinburgh, yeah. or Gogaburn. And it has its own internal street with a florist and with a supermarket and with other shops and a hairdresser. And one of the shops is a bookshop called Blackwell's, which is a mainstream bookshop. I don't know what the equivalent would be in the States, you know, one with branches all over the country. And so this, my book was apparently selling quite well in that shop, and that was good. Selling in the bookshop in the headquarters campus. But overall, yeah, I was very pleased. I had some great reviews. I had good reviews in the FT, and I had good reviews in Bloomberg. I had good review in a number of different publications, and they were all very positive. I was almost overwhelmed. And I think one other thing is that I've had these regular emails from RBS staff members who've read it and said they couldn't stand the culture. They felt it was just, you know, there was a toxic culture inside that bank, mm-hmm. and they were delighted that I'd written the book, and they'd really appreciated and enjoyed even the book.
I would say, wow, I mean, that's really high praise to have a high-level person at the bank recommending your book to the employees, especially when it's critical of the dealings on and everything that led up to it. But
I only learned that. I mean, I didn't know that. It was just, I had a friend who worked there who saw it, and he copied it in an email and sent it to me from his private email address.
So if nothing else, then he at least made RBS better, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, it might have done. But I mean, you do wonder, you know, things that the bank has done some pretty bad things, even after it was saved by the taxpayer. We could go on to, if you've got time. I don't know how
long. We got time.
We got plenty of time.
Well, you know, it was recently found to have been engaged in money laundering and accepting.
Oh my God.
Bin liners full of cash. Do you know what a bin liner is? I don't know what you call them there. They're big black plastic. You line your garbage with.
Okay.
Garbage bags. So there were garbage bags of used notes were being delivered by Fowler Oldfield, which is a jeweler and gold dealer based in Bradford in north of England. And these were being delivered to an array of NatWest branches, who was then taking them in and converting them, you know, accepting them, and then crediting the amount to the client's accounts. And so this was going on for many, many months. And the bank was criminally prosecuted for this and ended up paying a fine of about £250 million, which is not that high, much less than HSBC was fined in the States for laundering drug money. Mm-hmm. It was still a major thing. You know, this is a bank that you'd have thought that a bank that's been saved by taxpayers might make some effort to improve its culture,
right,
and improve its behavior and not get engaged in these sorts of things. But, you know, that was one example. And before that, you had things like foreign exchange rigging, for which the bank was fined $1.6 billion. You had
foreign exchange. They weren't the only ones either, were they?
No, there was a whole cartel of banks which were rigging foreign exchange markets. And they formed different cartels, and one of them was called Sterling Lads. One was three-way banana split, and there was a number of other ones. In total, RBS was fined for all this foreign exchange rigging activity. It was fined a total of $1.6 billion. And then for rigging LIBOR, RBS, which again, this happened after the crash, RBS was fined a total of $1.1 billion. 612 by the CFTC, DOJ, and Financial Conduct Authority, and the rest was by the European Union. So there's things that have been going on. And then, you know, another thing which I feel strongly about is that RBS, between 2009 and 2013, deliberately destroyed tens of thousands of UK small and medium-sized companies in order to profit from their demise. And this is a really heinous...
kind of like gutting the companies?
Well, seizing their asset stripping, basically, you know.
Right.
It particularly valued ones which had freehold properties, so ones that owned their own properties outright. And it would use a number of different ploy, a different, RBS, which is now called NatWest, would deploy a number of tactics to basically manufacture defaults, which in what were otherwise profitable, credit-worthy companies. And it would do this by, for example, putting phony valuations on the company's property assets. So if it had a warehouse that was worth, say, $5 million. It might say this warehouse is actually only worth $900,000. It would get an attainment firm of chartered surveyors. I don't know whether you call them that, but that's what we call realtors.
Appraisers, I think, here.
Yeah, appraisers who would put a much lower value on the asset. And then RBS could actually claim that company was in default because its loan to value ratio was below the required. Right. Level, you know, basically his asset might be worth less than its loan. And then it could, you know, basically manufactured a default, put it into this division of RBS called Global Restructuring Group, which would then basically siphon out cash through outrageous fees and charges, which would bump up interest rates on loans and would use other methods, some of which had been commenced earlier through the missale of things called interest rate hedging products, to basically you know, put the company on its knees so that then the company could be put into administration and the company's assets could be essentially seized by the bank. Oh, and this was partly because the bailout, the $45.5 billion bailout that we put in place in 2008 was discovered not to be sufficient to keep RBS afloat. Mm-hmm. So this activity that I'm describing was a way of sort of topping up the bailout at the expense of UK small and medium-sized companies. And there's a massive scandal around that. It's been debated in Parliament about at least three or four times. There's been about four BBC programs specifically on it. But in the end of the day, the bank got off pretty much scot-free. And that was partly because we have a what we call a captured regulator here who isn't actually, mm-hmm. who people argue is not that interested in rooting out malpractice or fraud within the banking sector. So, yeah, I could say a lot more about that.
Oh, my God, wow. That's terrible.
Yeah, well,
has there ever been a scenario where they've done that to like individual homeowners, someone who owns a mortgage, like the bank coming in saying, hey, your house isn't worth that much now. You need to pay back your mortgage or I'm taking your house.
I'm sure there are cases. I mean, there's a separate thing. I mean, by the way, just on this global restructuring group scandal, you know, I've had people on the phone in tears, you know, grown men who have run businesses for 30 years and built up a successful business, who have suddenly found, for no reason other than the bank misbehaving, that they've lost their life's work, and you know,
right.
And often, you know, they're ostracized by their community because of it, because the community thinks that they're at fault,
right?
And the bank also tries to isolate people. So, you know, in the early stages of all this, the individual borrower would think, oh, it must be me, you know, it must be my fault. And it was only once certain journalists, including me, started to expose that this was going on at, you know, a much wider level, that people realized they weren't on their own. But there have been suicides, you know, there have been marriage breakdowns, there's been mental breakdowns, there's been some horrible fallout as a consequence of what happened with Global Restructuring Group. And you know, they behave like mafiosi, actually. And that to me is appalling, that a bank that's been rescued by the taxpayer, even after it's been rescued, should treat its own customers and the people who saved it, i.e. British taxpayers, in this sort of way. And what is even more appalling is that it's managed to get away with it.
Hmm. Where are those meddling kids when you need them? I don't know if you probably don't watch Scooby-Doo over there.
Yeah, I used to watch that when I was a kid. Ages ago.
It's not a ghost. It was Fred Goodwin all along.
Fred Goodwin and these matchsticks in a spotlight.
Yeah, we need them. We need them back. We need Scooby-Doo.
Yes, somebody.
I mean, the other thing, which is all part of that, is there's this signature forgery issue, which you had robo-signing, and I think in the end there was some settlements with that. That was after the banking crisis in the States. We had something called signature forgery, and it includes document falsification. And a guy I know who's himself a victim of a bank, he has assembled a dossier of evidence of about 700 plus cases which are properly documented, showing that UK banks have forged the signatures of customers on official documents, including loan agreements and in other things related to that, like PPI, which is personal protection insurance applications. So basically, the banks appear to have engaged in industrial scale signature forgery.
Oh my.
In order to pretend, in some cases, that customers have agreed to take out certain products, which could be loans, and RBS, I'm afraid, is among them. So,
wow.
Julian Watts is the guy. He started something called the Bank Signature Forgery Campaign, which you can find on Twitter. But the depressing thing about that is also, I think, in the States, if someone came with over 700 criminal cases of signature forgery, which is proven in some cases by graphologists, to the main, the appropriate regulator, the crime-fighting agency, and they would be the FBI or something like that, SEC, you know, you'd have thought the regulators might actually prick up their ears and say, hey, this looks quite bad. We better have a look.
Right.
And you would assume actually that would happen in the United States. But here it's been there's a body called the National Crime Agency, which is a UK-wide crime-fighting force, which has had this evidence for 2.5 years and has done absolutely nothing. It's just sat on it.
Wow.
There's a lot of people wondering, you know, why is it not interested?
Right.
Does the NCAA see its role as to protect the banking sector, or are they just, is it too hard for them to get their heads around, or do they not believe the evidence,
or does it just take that long to put a case together?
Or well, maybe. If Jared was there, they'd do it a lot quicker. Jared Bibler.
I would think so. But I know here that with the SEC is regularly you see judgments and fines and things come out for things that happened 2-3 years ago.
Yeah. Well, that is true. But you'd have thought they would at least contact, if they were going to investigate, they would have at least contacted some of the witnesses.
Yeah, you would think.
Even that hasn't happened yet. So we'll have to see.
What's that famous quote, Dan, by Thomas Jefferson about banks?
Can't trust them? I don't know.
Here it is. Said that I believe the banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies.
Oh,
said that in 1802.
It's amazing.
Wow.
It's amazingly true. Even today,
yes.
You get a form of financial tyranny, you know, where banks basically are in cahoots with the government, and because the government may or may not be captured by the banking sector through donations or through other forms of lobbying, and where you have a regulator whose kind of interests are too closely aligned with the banking sector.
Does it help to have the royal in your name too? Like, does that basically saying like the government's condoning you, or like you're the chosen bank?
I think there is something in that. You know, when the bank got that title in 1727 when it was founded, it certainly gave it a greater legitimacy than its main rival here in Scotland, which Bank of Scotland, because the royal made it seem as if it was appointed by the Queen or the King at that time.
Right.
So yeah, I'm sure it does. You know, I think the Royal Bank of Scotland should have had its royal statute removed when Fred Goodwin had his knighthood removed, but it never happened.
They still have it?
They still have a royal
what?
They still have it. After all this, they still have it. They have actually changed their group name because they think RBS is now so tainted they can't carry on with that as their group name. They did change their group name in July 2020 to NatWest.
Yep.
So that was in some ways seen as a bad day for Scotland, but I don't think many Scots
I think Scotland would be happy to turn the page on this whole thing.
Well, that's true.
Or at least write the ending.
Yeah, a lot of people actually felt we didn't really give a shit.
Really?
Well, no, sorry. There were some people in Scotland who were disappointed that, you know, what had been, what once was a great bank, and it was till about the 80s or 90s, you know, that this great bank had had to lose its name and become NatWest. But for a lot of people who actually know what it's been up to over the past 2 decades, yeah, it was no loss.
That's yeah. which bank doesn't do all this stuff? Is there any that you know of?
I think that all banks get engaged in sort of various shenanigans over
yeah,
time.
That's what I was afraid of.
Yeah, I think they all do to some extent or another. I mean, with Wells Fargo, I was absolutely amazed about that. What was it they were doing? I mean, that was a form of signature forgery, wasn't it? They were opening current accounts without fake current accounts without people knowing, just so they could get extra. Do you know that story with Wells Fargo?
Yeah, no, I didn't hear that.
They charged them for the accounts that they were opening without their knowledge.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Jesus.
So that was maybe a classic case. And I think a lot of it boils down to incentives. If you incentivize your people, your staff,
right,
to sell more product, like more current accounts or whatever, then they are going to cut corners and they will miss-sell, which we have this crazy word called miss-sell, which means sell something which somebody doesn't want, but it's really fraud, you know.
Yeah.
So that there is a real risk that incentives given to either investment bankers or incentives given to retail bankers, who are the ones who work in the branches or in the call centers, to sell more product, the overall outcome is going to be bad for consumers, who will end up with products they don't need or products that
they didn't ask for.
That they didn't ask for at all, or which will charge them outrageous fees for a shoddy service. So yeah, but there are definitely some banks that are worse, better than others. And a bank which does stop paying bonuses and stop paying incentive payments to its own staff is almost certainly going to behave better. And one bank that has done that, I'm sure there are others, one bank that has stopped those payments is Handelsbank. Mm-hmm. And so it is more focused on service than sales. And I think that is the way to go. You know, that's how banking should be moving. But the trouble is whether the bank can keep its investors happy by doing that.
And can they keep their employees happy too?
Well, that's the other thing. But I think it's working at Handelsbank, and I need to know more about how it works, but it does seem to work. People aren't leaving. In fact, you know, a lot of people who got jaundiced by the unethical behavior of certain other UK banks have now work at Handelsbank, and they're much happier. They may be earning slightly less, but they're not poor.
I'd take a slightly less paycheck for a guaranteed one.
Yes.
Over the bigger one, but never knowing if you're going to hit it.
Yeah. So maybe that is the way forward. I don't know. I think it's Warren Buffett who says, you know, incentives drives, I wish I could remember the quote, but it is the key, you know, to a lot of the malpractice in the financial sector. You know, the whopping bonus for just selling one hedging product, which might cripple your customer, but might make your bank a 1 million day one profit. You know, the temptation is, oh, I'll take the 1 million day one profit, and I don't really care if I cripple my customer. I can't remember which strand we were on to now, but
I think we're talking about trying to find a bank we could trust, but
right,
sounds
right.
Like that might be an exercise in futility.
Well, I do think some of the Singapore banks will be worth a look, because they have better regulators in Singapore.
Just don't litter there.
Yeah, don't litter their pavements.
No graffiti.
Don't be rude about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's that either.
No graffiti, and don't be rude about the government, and then you'll be fine.
Yeah.
But that strictness makes for good banks then, huh?
Right.
Well, there's one particular bank, I think it's called DBS, which I don't know. I mean, it seems to be doing some very interesting stuff, what's called fintech, you know, with online and mobile apps, which are ahead of the game. So there are some new mobile app type banks in the UK, one of which is called Starling, which do seem to be slightly more ethical. So there is hope, you know, it's not all bad.
That's good to hear. It's starting to get a little doom and gloom there for a little bit.
Jared Biebler also was an advocate for incentivizing auditors and regulators with like maybe some bounties.
Yes. I think that would be a huge step in the right direction if you want to actually try to root out and stop some of these nefarious activities.
Yeah, because at the moment our regulators are not paid very much. They're paid about a quarter of or one third of what they'd get for the same job in a bank.
They're understaffed.
Yeah, and they want to be soft on the banks because then they will get a better paid job as a risk officer or chief risk officer with the bank that they're regulating. And I can think of numerous examples, actually, where a senior regulator within the UK financial regulator, which is called the Financial Conduct Authority and was the Financial Services Authority, has basically swept a massive fraud under the carpet or an alleged massive fraud under the rug at the regulator. Mm-hmm. And then a few weeks later, suddenly they get offered a job on, say, £3 million per annum as a chief risk officer for the bank, which they've just buried the fraud for. And I know of several cases where that exact scenario has happened.
Didn't we see that Janet Yellen was like getting paid like ridiculous speaking fees for talking to some of the people that she's supposed to be regulating now?
Well, that is just ridiculous. She shouldn't be accepting those, and she shouldn't be doing it.
I think it was before she took her position, or at least I hope it was, but I could be getting my timelines mixed up.
It's in between positions.
Yeah.
But even that is dangerous because, you know.
Oh, yes.
If you get like £250,000 for speaking for half an hour to Citigroup conference, you know, you're going to remember that money. It's quite a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And are you actually going to really pull out all the stops if you discover some frauds within Citigroup?
You're not going to want to jeopardize your livelihood.
Your friendship.
Yeah.
Yes, that. Exactly, Dan.
Yeah. We did have something very similar with HSBC, which is the biggest bank in the UK. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they basically threatened to move their head office from London to Hong Kong, back to their home city of Hong Kong, unless the government eased off on the regulatory tightening that was then going on. So they had about 6 points which they wanted, and they gradually ticked them off. The government basically, I think, succumbed to lobbying and or pressure from HSBC, mm-hmm. and diluted the ring fence which was proposed, and diluted the senior managers regime, and diluted various other harder proposals for toughening up bank regulation.
Reduced fees for money laundering.
Yeah, those sorts of things. And amazingly enough, at the end of that process, HSBC decided, hey, we're going to stay in Britain. And then they gave the chancellor who'd overseen it, a guy called George Osborne, who was the chancellor of the Exchequer through that process, they gave him a speaking fee to talk at Davos in Switzerland at the World Economic Forum. Oh. And I can't remember what it was, but it was short of £50,000 for the ex-chancellor at that time,
right,
to speak at the World Economic Forum in Davos at an HSBC.
That was nice of them. They must have just had a really good relationship.
Yeah. it had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that, you know, he'd done anything for them in the past. Of course.
Right. Of course. Ian, what's next for you now then? What, you got any other plans coming up? Is there anything else that you got on the horizon coming up?
Well, I've got a couple of books about banking, which I've been asked to do, but I'm not starting them quite yet because after Shredded, I needed a break from banking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Shredded is almost a decade long project. Yeah. It sounds like.
It's too long. I want it to be shorter. But anyway, I am working on a book about the history of Scottish industrial and commercial success. Mm. So looking at from 1707, the year we formed a union with England, mm-hmm. to the present day, what were the drivers of Scotland's commercial and industrial success? It once made about 40% of the locomotives for the entire world were made in Glasgow, and about 30% of the ships for the entire world were made in Glasgow. And, you know, there was other successful sectors like textiles and publishing. You know, HarperCollins is a Scottish company. So looking at what were the factors that gave rise to this commercial industrial success, but then looking at what caused the decline, because we had a bit of a decline in Scotland, I guess, it arguably started in the 1890s when German ships began to get better than ours. Mm-hmm. And diesel locomotives came in about the 1950s, and so the steam trains weren't so popular. So looking at the reasons for the decline from, I guess, it really kicked in about the 1920s, and looking for the reasons for that. But it's quite a long project because I'm trying to find examples of individual entrepreneurs and or companies which illustrate each of the reasons for the success and failure and decline. But in the last bit of the book, I'm looking at what are the chinks of light on the horizon in terms of, you know, what are the future sectors where Scotland might excel? And one of those is computer games, where we have a very strong computer gaming sector in Dundee, which is a town and city in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of things. You know, even though we've lost our banks now, we've still got a very healthy fund management sector based in Scotland, and we have the biggest exporter is Scotch whisky, which is thriving. You know, they sell £5 billion of Scotch a year to all the world markets. Well, you know,
nobody can go outside. What else is left to do?
Yeah,
they should be killing it.
Yeah. So I mean that in itself is an ancient industry. You know, they started distilling that stuff in the Middle Ages, but they started to kind of put brands on it. Like Johnny Walker.
McCallum's.
Yeah, McCallum in the 1820s. So it was the Victorians who made it, who started branding it and selling it internationally. Mm-hmm. But I could. The trouble is that I was asked to do this book, and I'd love to do something quite focused just on, say, Scotch whisky, because that in itself is a fascinating industry, but my publisher wants a much broader book looking at all the different sectors.
Of course I do.
Yeah.
Just do all of them. It'll be easy.
Yeah. I wish it was.
Right. All right, Dan, you want to take us home here?
Probably getting pretty late there. We're running long as it is. Thank you, Ian. This has been amazing. I'm so glad you got a chance to come by and talk with us today. Thank you again for coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it's been great fun. Sorry, this is me talking for the recording. Yeah, sorry.
Sure.
I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, I hope I've managed to explain some of the intricacies of British banking and what went wrong with it to your many listeners.
I think you did a fantastic job. And we've also got, we'll have links for the book, Shredded, Inside RBS, The Bank That Broke Britain.
Great.
We'll have links for that in the episode description. And Ian, is there anything else that you want to share before we turn the mics off, shut the lights down?
Kick you out.
Yeah.
I just like to say you're doing a great job. I love what you do. I think you've done some great podcasts.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We left the mic. We left the recordings on for that one, too. That's the first time I managed to do that.
Oh, sweet. All right. That's going in the ad right there.
And you made them funny as well, which is, you know, that finance isn't usually funny, but you do make it funny. And I think that's great. I don't know how well I did in terms of making RBS funny. It probably made it seem quite.
I was laughing. You handled yourself well.
Yeah. Lots of it are quite tragic, yep. But there are lots of funny bits.
There's a 3-joke minimum, Ian, and you only hit 2, so we won't be asking you back.
Sorry about that.
Bullshit.
All right, folks. Until next time, we'll be coming back at you soon. Happy trades.
Bye. Thanks for joining us. You can find us off air at twobullsinachinashop.com. That's the number 2bullsinachinashop.com. Make sure you check us out. Download us on any streaming network, blah, 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 blah. You know what to do. Rate, subscribe.
Two Bulls in a China Shop is an entertainment program, and all thoughts and opinions expressed in the show belong to the hosts and not of any company. They are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide entertainment about stocks and the financial industry of trading. If you make trades based on what you hear in this show, you assume all risks for those trades.